Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Screen International's award season podcast series. I'm Matt Mueller, the editor of Screen International, and today we speak to Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, the screenwriters of Avengers Endgame. The Walt Disney Studios motion pictures release has become the highest grossing film of all time, with $2.8 billion at the global box office. Christopher and Stephen, who are also co-producers on the Marvel Studios production, spoke to my Screen International colleague Michael Rosser about the screenwriters who most inspire them and their relationship with Marvel Studios president Kevin Feige. But first, the pair responded to the film's global success at the box office and audience reaction.
Hello, I'm Michael Rosser for Screen International, and it's my great pleasure to be joined by two writers who wiped out half the universe and then brought them back with a snap of their fingers. Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So as we record this, it's been 5 months since the release of Avengers Endgame, and it's been seen by audiences around the world, becoming the biggest movie of all time at the worldwide box office with close to 2.8 billion, I believe.
Something like it.
Yeah. So now that we can flash up 5 months later,
yes, sir.
In your own personal stories, have you had the chance to reflect on this amazing achievement?
Well, it's a hard thing to take in. It's like looking at the Grand Canyon. It's very, very big and kind of hard to find your spot in it. But when I think about it, and you think about that box office number, what that number has to mean is repeat viewings. And that's not because, you know, people like the punching. It's because there's a real emotional element in there, an experience that they want to go to again and want to feel again and want to go through again. And to have achieved that on this large of a scale is really satisfying.
It's repeat viewing, and it's also international viewing. I mean, you shouldn't be doing this on YouTube, right? You shouldn't be taking your camera into movie theaters. But I've watched shots of people in India and, you know, all parts of the world. And the audience just gets on their feet and screams at various times in the movie theater. And the fact that can happen throughout all these different cultures is really gratifying. That's why it's at 2.8 billion.
Was there a particular moment in sort of, you know, seeing audience reactions that you were pleasantly surprised at a gasp or?
Oh, the big ones come at the end, sure. For me. But if you're a fan, even a passing fan, when Steve Rogers is facing a ridiculous alien horde and is clearly going to go down swinging, and this little crackle happens in his ear, and Sam Wilson, who's been dead for 5 years, says, "On your left." And the ripple effect of what that means is coming is, I've seen people cry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just the calories here. It's this explosion of emotion, the 22 years of built up investment. I mean, that's what we're really talking about. You get to that kind of box office number because of the investment of the serialized storytelling. That's the big moment for me, is that portal scene, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I know this has been a long journey for you both at Marvel, which began around 10 years ago, I think, on Captain America, the First Avenger.
Yes.
Can you talk about exactly when you heard about that opportunity and how you got the job?
Iron Man had come out. I think that was it. Iron Man had come out, and we our agent told us that they were thinking of making a Captain America movie, which was really interesting to us because we had actually talked about what if you made a character, you made a comic book movie that took place at the time when the character was actually created, because so many of these great characters came out in the 30s or early 40s and were speaking to a societal need of the time. And when you transpose them to now, sometimes they don't work as well. So what if you took those societal needs and did it there? And Cap is probably the one who you need to do that most of all, because he makes absolutely no sense unless he comes from 1940. We were like that. Yeah, we want to go talk about that.
So we chased it all that summer of 2008. As a side note, we were very aware that Iron Man came out because we had a movie opening on Iron Man's second weekend, which was called Prince Caspian. It did not do nearly as well because Robert Downey Jr. was running roughshod over Hollywood. And so we spent that whole summer trying to get that job. And that meant reading comics, going to every comic book store in Los Angeles and getting those big compendiums that don't have any color in them, you know, and just reading all we could. And eventually got the job around the holidays of 2008, mostly just by sheer enthusiasm. I don't know if it was any brilliant idea we pitched.
Also, you know, even those meetings were collaborative. I mean, Marvel is a very collaborative company. And more than pitches, they were sitting at a table with Kevin and Stephen Broussard and talking about what a Captain America movie could be were you to tackle it. And, you know, and I think we developed a relationship even before we had the job that is part of the reason why we've had such a long run there, is because that's how we like to work and it's how they like to work, and it's a good fit.
And you worked across three Narnia films, right?
Yeah.
Yes. We were second writers in on the first one, and then we were the sole writers with Andrew Adamson on the second one, and then we were the first writers in on the third one, and then were asked to leave Narnia. Yeah.
And I wonder if there was anything that you learned in particular from, you know, working in that universe that you then brought to another universe.
I learned a lot. I mean, that really was our introduction to big budget filmmaking. We'd had one movie made prior to that, and I don't think it had come out yet. And
that was The Life and Death of Peter Sellers.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
You know, and they're very effects heavy, and there was a lot of previs and watching the movie before it was made, and it was very instructive about that level of storytelling. But it was also kind of reassuring in that those movies only work when you are there with those kids emotionally. And to know that even a movie of this scale and this budget is dependent on the personal, is dependent on the emotions of the characters, as opposed to, you know, how many lions you can make talk.
So you went on to write Thor: The Dark World.
In part, yes.
In part, yeah. And work with the Russo brothers on the next two Captain America movies, The Winter Soldier and Civil War. So when were you first approached about writing Avengers Infinity War and Endgame?
It was we were well into writing and prepping Civil War, but we hadn't shot it yet. So it was probably Christmas of 2014.
Wow.
And Joe Russo comes into our office and says, because at that point we were juggling the Agent Carter television show and Civil War. And we were, I think it's okay to say, a bit fried, because those were long days where there's a writer's room downstairs and we would visit there in the afternoon, but we'd try to crack the movie in the morning. And Joe said, it looks like they're going to offer us the next two Avengers movies. And I'm pretty sure you just groaned.
Yeah. Oh, no. It has been one continuous job effectively since we got Cap 1. And Civil War came very quickly after Winter Soldier. We basically never dismantled the team. We just rolled into that. And I was looking forward to a break. But instead came the two biggest movies ever made.
That's right.
And we just kind of nodded and went, you're out of your mind, but come back and talk to us again.
It meant we had to really think about what we wanted out of our lives and out of our careers. And it meant, you know, you've heard this before, the idea that if something scares you, maybe you ought to try to do it. It certainly is scary to say you're going to shoot two huge movies back to back with the cast, the size of which we were talking about, the ambition that Infinity War connotes. Right? Mm-hmm. And so there was and Avengers was a huge, big, great movie. You know, and Ultron hadn't come out yet by this point. And so we didn't know if we were going to fall flat on our face or whether we could do this, but we knew it was the biggest puzzle as screenwriters we'd ever have to put together. And so that, even with all the anxiety, I think that's what pushed us forward, is that the challenge was too great to pass up.
Yeah. Now, I've heard about this 60-page document that you wrote going into this. What can you reveal about the, you know, some of the more, in, you know, juicier contents of that?
Well, a lot of nudity. we've called it a manifesto, which is really the wrong, it's the exact opposite of a manifesto. It's 60 pages of completely contradictory ideas. It's just a list of things that could happen, storylines that have been left dangling that you could pick up. Things that happen in the comics that they have the rights to the characters for. And as many weird team-ups as we could think of, where, like, these two people have never been on the screen together. You're probably going to need to do that. And it really was a kind of a starting point to, like, let's narrow down what the collective consciousness is on this movie. Literally, circle what you like. Get a highlighter out and go, like, I like that, and I like that, and I like that.
It's like planning your wedding, you know, and you sit down and decide what the napkin's going to be, and you have to taste the chicken and taste the fish. And
turns out you have feelings about napkins that you never knew you had. Turns out you're vehemently opposed to a certain kind of chair. We did it during the shooting of Civil War, where everyone else was very busy making that movie. We would check in the morning, rewrite what needed to be rewritten, and we're free for the rest of the day to kind of read every comic book we could find and plumb the depths of Marvel. And it was a lot of really important R&D to just ingest into our brains whether or not it was literally the plot that was going to be on screen. It was, you know, we learned everything.
Hmm. Because I wonder if there's a sort of Marvel list of do's and don'ts, like when you kind of first work with them or something, that they say, you know, let's not do this. But it does sound like an exceptionally free environment as well.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, I think, is smart enough to know that if he starts limiting you early, he's going to, you know, cut off avenues that might be fruitful. So there's certainly things that we pitch that don't get any traction. Mm-hmm. And there are things that'll make third and fourth drafts that eventually people will go, yeah, we probably either can't afford or don't want to do that. But that's not early. Early was just literally, it's called Infinity War. It's got Thanos in it, and it's got six stones. You know about those, and he probably gets them. And that's sort of what we had to work with. And a mission to make it as epic as you can make it. Use anybody you can use.
But, you know, there are so many moving pieces in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they all need to connect somehow. So to what extent do you work with the talent behind Black Panther, Captain Marvel, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Spider-Man, Far From Home, all of which would impact and were impacted in some way by these movies?
Well, on a basic level, you read every script that you can get a hold of. See every movie you can get a hold of and talk to the people when they're available. Sometimes it's literally, I remember Steve coming back from the bathroom and going, I just met Taika Waititi. It was just like, I'm not going to ask the circumstances of that. Other times it's arranged meetings and you try to absorb as much as they're doing. A lot of the time you have to go out on your own and hope, you know, that your respect for the character is going to prevent you from doing something so egregious that it conflicts with their movie, because the schedules are so varying that, you know, we'll be shooting stuff before they do and they're going to come out first, and it gets very it's impossible to have a completely regimented marching order.
Marvel has their own sort of internal logistics. There's one, it's Kevin overall, but then there's one producer on each project, and they're doing a lot of talking, from what I can tell.
Is it the Marvel Parliament?
They call themselves the Parliament, yes.
Right. Yeah, I'm not going to make any further comments.
Yeah, no, I don't know who named it.
It's despite that, it seems very well run.
but there are things that are seeded in these other movies sort of pay off, and so is some of that. How much of that is by design?
Sometimes, again, I'm not with Kevin 24 hours a day, but I have to imagine sometimes he giggles at the idea that this has all been super planned, right? Because there are certainly ambitions, but if this whole thing was regimentally scripted and planned for years and years out, you wouldn't have very good movies. You wouldn't have chances to surprise. So yes, there's an ambition. Like even probably in 2012, they were thinking it would be great if Thanos came back and united everyone against him, right? But didn't take too many steps to do that.
It is sometimes those things are deliberately planted. Sometimes you drop, when you know you're in an interconnected universe, it's fun to just sort of mention things without knowing whether it's going to get picked up or not. Like we say the word Stephen Strange in Winter Soldier. I still don't completely know how they know about, but it's just fun to do that. And you can go back later and go, now we can pick it up. You know, didn't not fully have the intention of picking it up again, but...
But in general, Marvel wants to make the best movie in front of them.
Yeah.
So that there's... I really can't think of an instance where, say, something we could have used is purposely kicked to another movie, right? Because it would be better 6 years from now or something.
We did specifically speak to the folks making Ant-Man and Wasp and Captain Marvel about, like, okay, you two come in between our two movies. We really need these two endings.
That's a unique situation. Usually it's not that, but we needed at least one person trapped in the quantum realm and that kind of thing.
So Marvel Studios president Kevin Feige is very much seen as the architect of all this, overseeing the incredible success of the MCU. Can you talk about how your dealings with him shaped the script for Endgame?
He lets people do their best work, but he is an incredibly sharp audience goer. He's a great storyteller, and yet he doesn't write and he doesn't direct, but he's a great storyteller. So if you're thinking too small, he'll remind you not to think small. I specifically remember we're about to shoot a bunch of stuff for Infinity War, and he brought in sort of the big omnibus with all these dog-eared, posted papers, pages all over the place. And he wanted to flip through and make sure that we were being as crazy as Jim Starlin was, right? To make sure that there was a cosmic element to it, that we weren't missing some of the trippy nature of his comic because, at some point we have to make a grounded movie and it can't always be this trip. But by doing that, a number of things got into the movie, or at least we pushed things even further. You know, things got sort of nuttier. I think that wizard duel on Titan at the end of Infinity War, where Thanos fights Doctor Strange and things get really weird, is sort of a child of that. You know.
Yeah, I hear there was a scene where was it Strange was going to blow Thanos' mind.
Oh, you've done your homework, yes. Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he was... it was not unlike when in the original Doctor Strange movie, the Ancient One smacks him on the head. He goes astral out of his body and experiences the depths of the universe, and hands grow out of fingers and all the weird stuff. Basically, Strange did the same thing to Thanos, and we got a sense of, you know, the destruction that Thanos has caused throughout the universe, and the souls that might be crying out for justice. And eventually he was brought before this character from the MU, the Living Tribunal, who is a cosmic judge with three faces, who pronounced him guilty. And it was very trippy. But also, it completely took you out. You're in the middle of a battle. And now you're pressing pause on a battle to have a psychedelic experience and then come back. Takes, you know, it deflates the tension. It also posits a higher authority, you know, whether it's a hallucination or not. You know, if you start saying there are gods, I mean, not that people have
celestials, already, yeah, to be fair, yeah.
Then you're going, well, why don't they just, what are the stakes now? These guys can come in and stop it. There's a judge. So it's not the kind of thing you want to drop lightly into the, into
seemed,
the climax of your movie.
It tough for Act 3.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So 11 years, 21 interconnecting movies. This has never been done before.
No.
Writers usually draw on inspirations that inform how they tell their stories. But what else is there like this? I mean, were there any movies at all that would come to mind when you were writing this?
We joked about It's a Mad World. But no, we talk about Game of Thrones and remind ourselves that there were characters over the course of that series who we, the audience, knew very well and knew were in that series and were part of the story but had never met, you know, and that somehow didn't, I was never triggered by that. And sometimes I was eager to watch them meet. And we knew that that would be part of the secret sauce of this movie, this, the anticipation of your two favorite characters from different franchises coming together.
Although that was almost
more
Infinity War than Endgame.
Yeah.
You know, we often do have template movies for things we write where you can just learn, you know, the Winter Soldier is very much inspired by the 70s paranoid thrillers. This really didn't. I mean, you could maybe, it's like Godfather 2, you know, something giant and sprawling. But it really is the the end result of 21 preceding movies. It is not beholden to the comics. It's not beholden to another movie we were trying to ape. It is the climax of 22 movies of storytelling, which I think you're right has never been done before, and was a big challenge and a big honor to be handed all these strings from all these other artists to go, okay, now tie them up.
Right.
And the fact that we didn't fall on our faces is remarkable to me.
So how long did it take you to actually break the story?
Well, we got serious about breaking it, say September of 2015. And that the next 4 months we were locked in a conference room, broke both. So we had two outlines by January of 16, and then went to draft on both those scripts. Now they changed plenty, but the stories essentially were the same. The end of the first movie was a snap, and the end of the second movie was Tony's death and Steve going back in time and all that. So the big plot points were always the same.
So you knew that the death of Tony Stark was coming many years
before. Isn't that weird? Yeah, we've been sitting on Tony's demise for years.
Do you not sort of just walk around thinking, oh, God, I hope no one can read my mind?
I have often thought it's really important, because I take pictures of the whiteboard at the end of every day to make sure that, we don't lose any work in case maintenance accidentally erased it or something.
Yeah.
And I've often thought that if I were mugged for my phone, it would be bad news for Marvel.
People hacking your phone as you say this now.
I've actually seen that photo, and it just looks like Tony Pies.
Tony Pies.
That's right.
That's the secret code. So that if someone were to walk in, they would go, oh, Tony Pies. It's clearly a movie about baking.
This sounds delicious.
So before we get back to the movie at hand. Mm. Who are your top movie writers of all time, and what are your favorite scripts?
Oh, I like Lawrence Kasdan. That's a guy who early on I went, oh, look at those. Be nice to do those types of movies.
Robert Towne.
Sure. William Goldman. I mean, it's I've we have a TV in our office that's always on in the lobby, right? And I lose many, many minutes just watching when Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid is just on all day. It's just a lovely movie.
It's weird that we're as subject to the over-promotion of directors throughout the ages as everybody else, so it's hard to bring the writers' names to mind of your favorite movies. But they're and now I'm doing a disservice to them.
But obviously, having written many scripts yourself, is there? Do you each have a script of someone else's that you think?
Oh, that was a great script. One of the reasons. I'll just steal this and Chris won't get to answer. One of the reasons we got into this is because we met in grad school around the time a movie called Seven came out. And we watched that with a bunch of our friends, and it scared the pants off of us. But most importantly, it was a tight, tight script. I mean, it's dark and macabre, but so much of the violence and the gore is in your head. It's not necessarily on the screen. But it's just a Swiss watch of a movie that by the time he walks into the police station at the end of Act Two and says, "Detectives, you have no idea where this movie's going." And I love that. And so that's Andrew Kevin Walker. And it's actually something we tried to ape in Civil War, just the idea where you don't quite know what your third act's going to be because you're off kilter.
And having this guy in the background.
Yeah, that's right. That's the thing we couldn't talk about, until the movie came out.
Absolutely.
I always go back to Chinatown. I mean, one, because it is so complex, but it's also incredibly evocative on a scene-to-scene basis. And for as much as it's an unraveling, there are things you still don't know. I mean, something terrible happened to Jake back when he was a cop in Chinatown. You never know. But it's the thing that haunts him throughout the movie. God, it's just beautiful. Makes me happy.
Now, am I right in thinking that you were on set every day, pretty much?
But yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, for the most part.
I think I had a cold at one point.
Well, you went to the hospital once too.
Yeah, well, that was from set.
Oh, right. So.
Yeah. As a result of being
it's a long story. He was fine.
No, I was fine. It turns out, just if you were ever on a set, and if you have like muscle strain that happens to be in your chest, which is causing a pain in the area of your chest, if you say to the set medic, "I have a chest pain," he is then required to call an ambulance by law. And I was like, not that kind of chest pain.
Too late.
You said the word chest pain. So
now,
it was a fun day.
So were you called in to address any issues like on those days you were there?
Oh, yeah. That's
they were
the
like, writers?
Well, yeah, we're not there just for, you know, our sparkling personalities. On a big movie like this, sort of any blockbuster, I guess, when you're shooting, let's call it a page a day, the most important part of the day for the writer is the beginning, because you're going to block the scene. You know, the actors are going to talk to the directors and sort of block it out and decide what they're going to do for the day. And if any changes come out of that, either we realize this door is actually a window, so we got to rewrite that, or an actor has an inspiration, or in rehearsing it, somebody has a great idea, then in that case, as they go back to makeup, Chris and I huddle with Joan Anthony Russo and they say, all right, here's what's come out of this. So we're going to need a few alts for this idea, or we're going to rewrite here, or whatever. So then Chris and I are sort of valuable from 8 to 10. And then once it's up on its feet, you know, it's probably going to be that scene all day. And so that's when we go to craft services.
But a lot of the time also, Joan Anthony, you know, that's when we can get Joan Anthony. Between shots to talk about a different scene.
That's a good point.
And they, particularly on these movies, they assemble and edit with Jeff Ford, the editor, without whom we would not be here, every night. They assemble what mm-hmm. they've got and start looking at it and start forming opinions about what they need. And a lot of the time we'd meet with them on a Tuesday because Monday night they watch what we shot last Thursday and go like, yeah, we need a thing right. there, or it just doesn't make sense. So it was very much a sort of ongoing evaluation of what had come before.
So on a daily basis there, it's assemble Avengers.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm terribly sorry.
Well played.
Terribly sorry.
Whatever you do, don't cut that out.
So was there a particular example of something where they said, we need to approach this?
Oh, for sure. I'll go back to Infinity War. Mm-hmm. There's a sequence where Doctor Strange and Tony and Peter Parker are on a spaceship and they have to rescue Doctor Strange and make decisions. That scene, we probably shot that three times. And we had various ways that to get Doctor Strange out of the bind he was in. But because that set was up and it was so big and we had the actors at various times, always, we could take a few cracks at that scene. So we eventually settled on a much simpler scene. Then we had it was a very heavy action scene that the movie didn't want at that point. So we have a much simpler scene where it's sort of an homage to Aliens. Is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where they just blow a hole in the ship and suck the bad guy out. Yeah.
And to some extent, Indiana Jones.
Yeah, so there's the swordsman fight. Yeah, the aborted swordsman fight.
So by now, these actors have spent many years with these characters. So to what extent could, you know, Robert Downey Jr. suggest a different approach for, you know, his delivery?
Oh, I mean, he can do it anytime he wants. He does do it often because he is, you know, he digests this whole thing prior. And that's his process, is to sort of take in what you've written, verbalize it. I'd never experienced anybody work this way. He takes in your script. It comes back out of him slightly rephrased. He writes it down, gives it back to you. It's fascinating. Because it's part of him keeping it somewhat improvisatory for himself, which is how he works, even though it's pre-planned.
he kind of doesn't love saying the same line more than once. So if we are having this scene here where he's being interviewed and we did this take over and over again, he wouldn't, even if I said, hi, Mike, you know, the next time it would be, sup, Mike? And the next time it would be, Mike, it's very good to see you today. Like, he would never say hi, Mike again.
Wow.
Yeah. And sometimes, like, really important nouns that you really need in there fall out. And you're like, okay, no, like...
Gotta say quantum realm.
Please say that.
So it's interesting, therefore, that his death scene, which I understand, you know, there was something of a speech. I understand that he took that down to...
Oh, to almost not, nothing, you know. Yeah. And that's a good example of, you know, you can imagine when we're writing it, you know, we feel the obligation to send Tony Stark on his way, particularly in the first draft. And we want to make sure that our readers, which are, in this case, all the production people, get a little tear in their eye. So we do our damnedest to make that happen. Mm-hmm. It's Robert when he gets there, and that's approaching for many months. He knows what's coming, and I'm sure he's thinking about it. And he's got ideas, and he wants much less. And he was right ultimately, because what I didn't quite understand was the guy who always had something to say throughout all of these movies suddenly rendered speechless. Mm-hmm. He's the most heartbreaking thing you can do in that moment.
Yeah.
And that's because he's a really good instinctive actor, you know?
And also, I mean, on a character level, Tony is so verbal and always doing this tap dancing, partly out of some sort of anxiety. And if he still had that, even after he had saved the world and was about to die, it actually would be tragic. But there is something great about him finally not having to do that anymore. You know, the voices in his head have quieted. You know, it requires dying, but it's nice that it happened.
So there's a speech out there somewhere that will never see the light of day.
It wasn't so much, wasn't a speech. It was a lot of people
getting their chance to say
goodbye.
Yeah,
because we had all the important characters right there. It was like, well, he's got to say something to Cap.
It's a bit of a receiving line. Yeah. And so
hey, Tony, don't die yet. I got something.
That's right. They took a number.
Now, this might be quite a short answer, but as I understand it, Endgame was about 99% done before Infinity War came out. Is that right, in terms of the...
No.
Yeah, it's probably more in the high 80s, but yeah.
So I just wonder if the reaction to Infinity War from the overall movie to individual moments, if that inspired any changes whatsoever to Endgame.
I don't know about changes. Certainly... a confidence to lean into things.
Such as if
people had been totally blasé about the snap and the ending of Infinity War, you know, there might have been some sort of rethinking of Endgame. But I don't know if we would have even had the ability to change anything by that point, but we take a really long time sitting in the aftermath of the snap. And I mean, we take 5 years, and the taking it very seriously and taking the after effects of it very seriously. And it was what we all wanted to do when we set out. If people were like, that's a gimmick. You know, that's nearly an hour of filmmaking that they've already dismissed as, you know, it doesn't matter. Because there were people crying in the movie theater who didn't get up and, you know, were just like, oh, we knew, like, oh, this is...
Yeah, act one's going to work.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, superhero movies have rarely been nominated for Academy Awards, let alone win for anything beyond the technical categories. Mm. Logan was nominated for... Best Adapted Screenplay, and Black Panther finally became the first superhero movie to be nominated for Best Film at the Oscars in 2019. Do you think that the performances, direction, and of course the writing deserves more recognition in that regard?
For the genre, I can't speak. I think it's on an individual basis. I mean, I think Endgame is a unique accomplishment by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's strange to be talking about the 22nd movie in a franchise that delivers the most emotional moments, I'd argue, probably in cinema this year. So that's a testament to Kevin Feige and to Joe and Anthony Russo and, you know, the departments that have been on this movie. Basically, as I said earlier, like, we only got here because everybody from Winter Soldier to Civil War to Infinity War to Endgame is all basically the same team. So there's sort of a handcraftedness to all of this because we've been working together for so long.
I mean, it is a testament to how genuine the work on these movies has been that the emotion is so high when they come to this endpoint. I mean, when Tony dies, that is this emotional payoff that has been building for however many years of the 22 that he's been in. And he has crafted a genuine character that people have fallen in love with. And it is not, oh, we really like that guy because he's the same every time. He has evolved, he has changed, he's overcome these difficulties. And that, you know, that is a rare opportunity for an actor. And I think he just destroyed it. So on you know, on an acting level, a directing level, I think it is unprecedented.
So can you talk about what's next for you guys? Uh-huh. Is it that long-awaited vacation?
Oh, God, I wish.
Isn't this my vacation?
That's right. We started a studio with the Russo brothers. And so we've been at it about a year and a half now, where Chris and I are the sort of quality control writing room in a way. So trying to replicate what we did, the process we all developed working on the last four Marvel movies. So writers come in and sit with us and we help them crack the story and then they go off and write the first draft and we give them notes. And the idea is that it's like a proper studio, except the notes you're getting are from Joe and Anth and me and Chris. Yeah,
they're not executive notes. They're constructive, creative filmmaker notes. So that it's not just what we find that's wrong with what you've done. It's advice on how to fix it, or, you know, really targeted criticism.
So we'll write one big movie a year for the company and then a couple smaller ones. And the first one that hopefully goes into production that Chris and I wrote is a story about Cambridge Analytica. And that's hopefully next year.
Excellent. And what's that called at the moment?
No title yet.
Yes, Untitled Cambridge Analytica Project.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that Kevin Feige has signed up to work on a new Star Wars movie.
Yeah, that was interesting.
It's exciting, right?
And your guy, Chris Evans, seems keen to be interested
in
that.
Oh, did he say something?
I didn't even
know. Yeah, yeah. So I wonder if that might, you know, bring you back to another epic universe.
Oh, geez.
I don't
Kevin's got my number.
I hope the cloning has gone well and that the new Kevin's 2 and 3 are up and running, because that is a lot of work.
I worry for his health.
Yes.
So I'm interested to know, as we're starting to run out of time here, but I would like to ask about how you split responsibilities as writers, you know, and why do you work well together?
I do all the verbs. Steve is more of a noun man.
Yeah. No one handles articles. We've developed a process over our 20 something years together, where we outline it together. And those are long, hard days where you're eliminating possibilities and it seems like nothing gets done. And once we have a good outline, usually that's been blessed by producers or people who are paying us, we will then split that up. And so each of us gets the pleasure of writing first drafts on our own, in our own time, in our own space. And we'll put that together at the end of every week and read it, but we won't touch it. And after 5 or 6 weeks of amassing, we'll have this sort of ugly draft that then the third part is we rewrite that together. And that's when we're back in the same room and getting in and out of the chair and revising things we haven't touched yet. And that usually tends to lead to a draft in about 10 weeks, 12 weeks, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And why do you think you work so well together? If you do.
You don't have any choice.
That's right. We learned the craft together. That's an interesting idea that's just occurred to us, that yeah, that it's not like I was an established novelist had Chris come join me, right? Let's say you're going to move into an apartment with your significant other, right? Do they move in with you, or do you move into a new place together, right? So Chris and I moved into a new place together, which was learning how to write screenplays. So I don't think there was any, no one was possessive about anything because mm-hmm. we didn't know what the heck we were doing.
Mm-hmm. So looking back on the movie with some distance, do you have a favorite line from Endgame?
For some reason, I can't completely say why, I'm really very fond of when Cap says, Black Widow says, it's going to work. And he says, I know, because I don't know what I'm going to do if it doesn't. Just pleases me.
Well, it's fraught with anxiety. Yeah. You know, it's not the greatest line in the world, but what it means and what the scene is when Cap leans over and whispers, Hail Hydra. I'm particularly chuffed by that.
That was such a juicy moment in my screening. So unfortunately, that's all we have time for. So it just remains for me to say thanks so much for your time, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to our special guests, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely. We hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Screen International podcast. Head over to screendaily.com to keep up with all of our award season podcasts. The Screen International podcast is a PPM production. The producer is Rebecca Grisdale-Sherry. That's all for now. See you next time.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.